here with us on The Morning Show as we talk about a middle-class tax cut proposal by Wisconsin Republicans. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at how this proposal compares to a plan proposed by Governor Tony Evers. Republicans are holding a hearing today to address the tax cut. WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White is here to tell us about it and how lawmakers seek to pay for it. Laurel, thanks for coming in.
Absolutely, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So Republicans are holding this hearing later today, which would be funded, this tax cut would be funded by a budget surplus. Mm-hmm. What should we expect from this hearing?
So this is a public hearing. So in this stage of the legislative process, this is really an opportunity for the sponsors of the bill to give individuals a little bit more information about the bill, more backstory. They can answer questions from other lawmakers. And it's also an opportunity for people who might be hurt by the bill or benefit from it to come into the Capitol and testify before lawmakers. Now, generally, this isn't a time where debate can happen between the two parties or two different sides of an issue. But oftentimes we do see lawmakers sort of slide in a little bit of debate, especially in kind of the way that they ask their questions. So this is meant to be more informational, but I'm guessing that there will be some political kind of fireworks a bit today as folks clash on whether this is a good idea or not.
Yeah, so what is the backstory of this bill? Mm-hmm. What do we know about the proposed GOP tax cut plan?
So it was rolled out in the middle of last month, so we've had a little bit of time to get familiar with this proposal. Under the proposal, families that make less than $100,000 or $150,000 a year and individuals that make less than $100,000 would get that tax cut. It's going to vary, of course, based on income, but it would be about $200 a year for the average family. And this is something that Republicans are funding, as you said, with that budget surplus. Some people are a little sensitive about using the term budget surplus, actually, because it's essentially the fund is what's being rolled over from the previous state budget. So it's money that wasn't spent in the previous budget. It's rolling over to this one. But some people say, well, that doesn't make it a surplus. It's just kind of a pot of money. So I think there might be a little bit of debate about that verbiage today in the Capitol.
And how have Governor Evers, how have Democrats responded to the plan?
They've been kind of concerned with that source of funding in particular. The governor, pretty quickly after Republicans rolled out this proposal, called it unfunded. And the reason he's saying that is because it is funded by that little pot of money, right, that's being rolled over. And there's no guarantee that the same amount of money is going to be rolled over from every budget for the rest of time. So he says, once we tap this money that exists for this budget cycle, how are we going to pay for this in the future? And if we put this tax cut on the books, that's sort of obligating Wisconsin taxpayers, state lawmakers, budget drafters to come up with this pot of money no matter what, forever. And that could be a challenge if that rollover doesn't happen again. So he says that his plan, which we can talk a little bit more about in a bit, is a little bit more sustainable for cutting taxes versus this Republican plan.
Right, because he's looking at scaling back a corporate tax credit program that mm-hmm. Republicans created during the Walker administration. How have Republicans responded to that proposal?
Yeah, so what's really interesting about this whole back and forth is that everybody wants the same result. They're just concerned about how to get there. Republicans want a middle-class tax cut. Governor Evers wants a middle-class tax cut. Republicans want to use this pot of money. Governor Evers wants to scale back this tax credit program. And that's something that Republicans have said is really concerning to them. It's really a non-starter because they equate that to a tax increase for the individuals that are currently taking that credit. The way that this tax credit works is that it offers tax breaks to individuals who work in agriculture or manufacturing. And Governor Evers wants to take the very top income bracket of that tax credit and roll it back. So those individuals wouldn't be able to claim the tax credit. They'd have to pay taxes on that income. He says that those are, a very small percentage of individuals, very wealthy individuals, and that that's a fair thing to do in order to offer this middle income tax cut. Republicans say that with the state of the Wisconsin budget being as it is, there's no reason to raise taxes or take away a tax break for absolutely anyone. So they're really digging their heels in on this. And that's kind of the fundamental conflict as this debate moves forward.
Talking with Laurel White, she's WPR's state capitol reporter. We're looking at options for a middle-class tax cut proposal and the path that Republicans want to take, the path that Democrats want to take. Laurel, is there any room for bipartisan compromise here? Republicans have framed this as a win-win. They say Governor Evers campaigned on a middle-class tax cut and that they've come up with a plan. Can we see any side giving here?
That's such an interesting question because it is a case where they both want the same thing. So can they find a similar path to walk down to get to that shared goal? You know, Governor Walker had a condition for raising the gas tax when the gas tax debate was happening during the last budget cycle. He said, "I'll accept a gas tax increase if you can cut another tax, a corresponding amount somewhere else in the budget." And it seems like Republicans are kind of setting a similar ground here, saying we're okay with an income tax cut as long as no other taxes are raised to pay for it, right? So if Governor Evers could potentially come up with another source of revenue that doesn't come across as a tax increase to the Republican sponsors of this proposal, it seems like they might be on board with that. But it seems like the governor is incredibly committed to funding his proposal with that change to that tax credit program. So I think it would be a pretty fundamental shift for either side of this debate to come up with a different revenue stream. But I do know that both sides are very committed to this tax cut. They think it's a really good idea to give the middle class a little bit more money in Wisconsin. So I don't know. It's going to be really interesting.
we'll put a to be continued on that. While we have you with us, let's take a look at that news about Foxconn, that there was quite a bit of confusion last week. Can you briefly tell us where are we at with the Foxconn situation and what's going on?
So as briefly as I can, the answer is we're kind of back to where we were before all of this confusion happened. Essentially, what we knew at the beginning of last week was that Foxconn was going to make small screens, small televisions at its plant in southeast Wisconsin. That's a scaling back from their original plan at the very beginning. They were going to make these really big screens, but because of supply issues, they had to scale that back. Last week, there were questions about whether or not they could make those small screens. So the company actually seemed to confirm that. Then there was a conversation with President Trump, and they're back on the small screens now. So it was a little bit of a small screen, no screen, back to small screen situation. So we're back where we started a little bit.
Laurel, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. We've been talking about a middle-class tax cut proposal that Wisconsin lawmakers want to move through with differing ways to pay for it. We also touched on Foxconn. Join us tonight at 8 as President Trump will give his State of the Union address. WPR will bring you live coverage of the speech and the Democratic Party response. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly will be joined by national political correspondent Mara Liasson, congressional correspondent Susan Davis, and White House correspondent Scott Horsley. That's tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, it's teenagers don't exactly have a reputation for giving parents an easy time, but there's a lot of false information out there. We delve into the negative myths about adolescents and teens. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show as we talk about the lives of teenagers. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When I think of teen angst, I think of the movies I was watching when I was going through adolescence. The Breakfast Club, 16 Candles. I watched them over and over on the VHS tape rental. Reflecting on those teenage coming-of-age stories set in the 1980s, teen culture, and with all due respect to Molly Ringwald, portrayal of teens in movies just doesn't square with reality, and pop culture can perpetuate stereotypes. Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234. Parents and guardians, what assumptions do people have about your teenager that aren't correct? Does it bother you that people sometimes think the worst about adolescence? Or do you see your adolescents behaving the way the stereotypes say? Do you think pop culture and our mindset about the age group plays a role? Why or why not? Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Axelrod is a professor of psychology and director of the Human Development Center at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He also chairs the Institutional Review Board for the Protection of Human Subjects. He recently co-authored the book Great Myths of Adolescence, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate, and thanks for having me.
There's sometimes this attitude that, you know, we say kids these days, they aren't meeting the standards of past generations. But you and your colleagues dig into this. Is that the case?
Yeah, we, what we found was that many of the preconceived notions that we have about teenagers, that they're always irritable, that they're moody, that they're sex-starved, that they are withdrawn, that they hate their parents, all those things can be debunked by some strong empirical research that's available to us.
How does believing these stereotypes affect our relationships with this generation?
Yeah, I think that there's a few things that come to mind. The first is believing these types of myths and stereotypes, I think, perpetuates this idea that adolescence as a developmental period is wrought with problems. And again, when we look at research across a large group of kids, that may not necessarily be true. I think that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think that for, you had mentioned The Breakfast Club, for example. Mm-hmm. I think that what we see is popular culture promote a lot of these myths and stereotypes as well. And I think people watch these movies and television shows and they read stories and they believe that teenagers are supposed to act a particular way. And that leads me to, the third reason or the third point, and that is parents, I think, come to expect their teenager to act certain ways and may actually believe that their teenager is engaging in problem behavior, for example, when in fact what their teenager is engaging is something probably more typical.
How does it affect the teenagers who view, who consume this media, this pop culture, this music? What impact does it have on them?
You know, Kate, we're not really sure. I think that's a good question that is going to probably be a point of study over the next 5 to 10 years, particularly as we begin to think about adolescence as a more specific developmental period. So 25, 30, 40 years ago, adolescence really was lumped in with childhood. And so the research was primarily focused on kids, kids under the age of about 14. And then across time, we've seen also adolescents lumped in with adults. And so as a distinct period, adolescence has not been studied very much. So I think your question will probably be answered across the next 10 or 15 years as we do more research. But in my own experiences and what I've done as far as my own research and my own clinical work, I think what it does to teenagers is it creates a situation where adults in society don't have much empathy for teenagers. They don't make much room for teenagers to make mistakes. And I think that can really be a problem from a developmental perspective.
We're talking with Michael Axelrod. He is a psychology professor at UW-Eau Claire. He's just co-authored a new book with fellow researchers on the myths of adolescence. And teens, you can join in as you head off to school at 800-642-1234. What do you wish adults knew about what you're going through? Give us a call with your story. Parents, what assumptions do people have about your teenager that aren't isn't correct. 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Michael, let's look a little bit further into these myths that you go ahead and debunk through the course of this book. But this whole idea that you've been talking about, that adolescence ends at age 18, what lies behind that myth that once you're 18 and you're adult, how is it rooted into our cultures?
Yeah, that's a great question. I found that myth to be actually fun to learn about. For me, it started actually with the Disney princesses and heroines who, if you do much research in princesses and heroines, you learn that many of them were under the age of 18 when they came of age. And in fact, the coming of age lasted about a day, which both those things are certainly not true. In fact, Rapunzel, I think the story is 24 hours, essentially. And so, I mean, how many of us came of age in 24 hours?
Gotta collapse it.
Right. So one of the things that came up when we were looking at that particular myth is the different types of markers for when adolescence ends. And there are several different markers. The first is just age. So we think about adolescence, we oftentimes equate that to the teen years. So that would mean adolescence lasts from 13 to 18 or 19. There's biological markers. The onset of puberty, for example, might mark when adolescence starts. There's some markers when puberty ends, although there's some controversy about exactly when puberty ends. And then there are the societal markers. So things like when you graduate high school, right? So an adolescent goes to high school. They're mentored, presumably, by adults. When they graduate high school, again, presumably, they're ready to go off and be independent. So those societal markers like marriage, having children, being financially independent, those markers are also often equated to when adolescence ends. And then the other markers that we look at are things that are more related to the laws that we have. So, you know, at age 18, you can get a tattoo. You can skydive without parental permission, those kinds of things. So there's all these different markers for when adolescence ends, which really makes it complicated to put an end date or an end time to adolescence. And so researchers and scholars in the area of developmental psychology are talking about maybe this now extended adolescent period or an emerging adulthood period as a new developmental piece to the whole picture.
What do we know about the brain in terms of development during this time?
Right. And so that's another part is thinking about, okay, when does the brain stop developing? And neuroscience would tell us that the brain actually continues to develop well into adulthood, which is good news for many of us as I'm turning 50 soon. And that's good news for me. A lot of people have always felt, though, that the brain stops developing when adolescence is over. And so things like risk-taking, learning about emotions, those things should be developed by 18. And again, we look at the research on brain development. We know that structurally and chemically, the brain is continuing to develop well past the age of 18.
You also mentioned there are various things that signal stages of puberty, and there's this myth that girls universally experience puberty sooner in recent years. What's behind that stereotype?
Yeah, there's some accounts, and if you look, even popular media outlets will talk about accounts of very young children as young as 7 or 8. Starting to go through puberty. And what we find is those cases are rare. But those are the cases that, of course, are magnified by media attention.
So why is that myth complicated? And what can parents do to, kind of push back against some of these misconceptions?
Yeah, so the biggest one that I see, I think, is the notion that teens these days are worse behaved than previous generations. That's the thing that the myth that I hear the most from parents and colleagues and educators when I'm consulting. And that particular myth is interesting because what we know is that teens are perhaps actually better off these days than teens from previous generations.
We're cutting teenagers some slack here on The Morning Show. A new book aims to debunk the idea that teens these days are worse than in previous generations. Michael Axelrod is our guide. He's a psychology professor at UW-Eau Claire. Educators and employers, what is your experience with teenagers? What do you wish people knew about this age group? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Coming up, it's news. Then we'll continue the conversation about teens and the world they live in today. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at misconceptions about teenagers on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers find most teens don't have a rocky relationship with their parents. In a study from 2010, it found 67% of adolescents have a secure relationship with their parents, and this finding was consistent with previous research. That's referring to myth number 34 in a new book about teens that tries to dispel these misconceptions. How is your relationship with the teen in your life? How do you find common ground and keep communication lines open? Teenagers, how do you feel about the way you're portrayed today in pop culture? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Michael Axelrod is our guide. He is a professor of psychology and director of the Human Development Center at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and he contributed his research to the new book, Great Myths of Adolescence. Let's go to the phones now, and let's have Tori from Madison join us. Tori, hi.
Hi.
What's on your mind about this?
Well, it's just boggling to me how parents expect children to handle puberty and then the amount of workload put on them by schools these days, and then they expect us to get good grades and stay in shape and participate in after-school activities while all of these hormones and puberty are just rushing through us. It's just so stressful.
How do you cope with that stress?
Honestly, I just spend a lot of time with my friends, and I have procrastinated on a lot of my homework today, but I don't know. I don't feel as connected to my parents as most of my other friends. Maybe it's just because of the workload from school.
You don't feel like your parents can truly relate to what you're going through?
I mean, I know they were my age once, and I know that they've been through what I've been through, or at least that's what they tell me. But I feel like nowadays it's harder to understand what your kids are going through.
Michael Axelrod, what do you hear?
Yeah, I think that what we see in terms of society is a lot different than when, like, I was a kid. And we see teens having to excel in order to get college scholarships, for example, academically. They have the social media to deal with, those kinds of things that are out there, technology. But if we look again at these long-term trends regarding teens, teens are actually doing pretty well. One of the studies that we looked at in our book was looking at pro-social behaviors, and parents and teachers report teens today are more socially skilled, better able to manage upset and have appropriate self-control, and actually volunteer more than teens from previous generations. As the caller said, you know, connecting socially with peers is really helpful, and I think that's something that as parents we need to really encourage. A lot of social opportunities for teenagers. Teenagers are a social creature, if you will, and I think that really promotes healthy development.
Let's bring in Steve from Altoona. Steve, hi.
Hi. I am helping my girlfriend raise her daughter and her other kids as well, but her daughter's the one I want to talk about. she is awesome. She is much better than any of us were as teenagers. She's a little social justice warrior. And on top of all of that, she helps her, you know, siblings get up and get ready for school in the morning. She's got her stuff together. And when I hear her talk about some of her, you know, some of her friends and people her own age, she really is doing a lot better than most of them are. You know, I hear stories from her that sound a lot like the Molly Ringwalds and that sort of thing. And we thank ourselves just about every day that she's not like that.
Thank you for those reflections, Stephen. I hope she was listening.
I really appreciated that caller, because one of the things we do in our book is talk about why people believe myths, why people believe nonsense. And one of the theories that that we have in terms of cognitive psychology is that people are more likely to believe or remember or pay attention to things that support their opinions and ignore things that go against their opinions. So we might, for example, pay attention to and remember the disrespectful teenager at the mall, but forget about the really respectful teenager who helped us at the grocery store. And I'm really glad that caller described a teenager who's you know, doing well.
So we have selective memory of our interactions with teens.
We do.
Let's bring in Alec, joining us from McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Alec.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
On my mind is that adults have the misconception that kids don't look up to them.
Well, and so you're a teenager, and that you feel kids don't look up to parents enough?
No, I believe that adults don't believe that kids look up to them. I believe that kids actually look up to them. Teenagers look up to them for advice and help.
Do you reach out for that advice and help? And what happens when you do?
When I reach out, sometimes I don't get it and sometimes I do. But most of the times I do, thankfully.
Alec, thank you for sharing that. Michael, there's this notion that teenagers should detach from your parents in adolescence, and that there is this separation. Are we hearing any of that here in what Alec says?
Yeah, I think that what we oftentimes believe is that certainly teenagers should detach physically from their parents. They, you know, as they graduate high school, many of them move out of the home, and so that's a sort of a normal developmental expectation. But to detach emotionally from parents, that's not expected, and we can thank Freud for that particular myth that teenagers are supposed to detach emotionally from their parents. In fact, what we find is that it's not so much that the parent child or parent-adolescent relationship involves detachment. It just changes, and it actually becomes stronger for many parents and teenagers, and becomes more intimate. College freshmen actually report talking more to their parents about deeper issues than they did as high school students. And so it just, I think, illustrates how the relationship evolves. And I think what Alex is talking about is that I think as adults, again, we assume that teenagers are rebellious, disrespectful, emotional. And those things can be true occasionally for many teens. But I think what the caller described was pretty typical, that teenagers do look up to us as adults, and I think we need to remember that.
What do you think people need to know about the teenage parent bond, that perhaps it's not as strained as we see on television or in popular culture?
Right. I think, you know, as I work with parents, for example, I try to encourage parents to allow their teenager some space in the relationship, and to allow their teenager to express to them their concerns and their the challenges they experience, as well as their successes. So giving some space. Now, that's not to say we should ignore our teens. On the contrary, I think we need to know what our teens are doing. But to really press them about things sometimes has a negative effect where teens will back away.
Let's turn to technology for a moment. So many of us are on our phones, mm-hmm. our devices all the time, regardless of whether we're a teenager or an adult. But teens seem to do that technology thing and multitask better than adults. Is this fact or fiction?
It's fiction. And there's it's interesting, as we were researching that particular myth, there's actually quite a lot of debate about whether multitasking itself exists. In fact, many researchers are suggesting now that we just quickly switch tasks, that we're actually not multitasking as we kind of think of doing two things at once. We're actually switching our attention very quickly. So there's a myth in that multitasking exists. The other thing is that there's a lot of research that suggests that that type of approach to tasks is not very productive. So that if you are doing two things at once, for example, checking email and reading something, that you're actually going to be less productive at both those tasks. And then the third myth, which is really related to this, to the myth that we covered in the book, is the fact that teens are better at multitasking because of technology. And that's just not true. What we find is that teens are not better at multitasking or switching quickly, and even when their technology use is quite high.
Is there any upsides to our adolescents interacting with so much technology and being so connected via that technology with their friends?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Teens that are engaged socially using technology through texting or social media actually have very well-developed social skills. So we have to be careful about how we manage teens' screen time. And so a lot of parents just say, well, we'll try to limit it as much as possible. Well, there are actually some benefits to kids using technology for social purposes.
What is recommended per research when it comes to screen time for teens? Is there anything out there?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of debate, and I don't think at this point we have a very clear understanding of when too much screen time is too much for teenagers.
We are with Michael Axelrod. He's co-author of the book Great Myths of Adolescence. You got a myth you want to debunk about teenagers? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. How do you keep communication lines open with your teenager? And when you look at them, are they a reflection of previous generations or not? Or is it not so simple than that? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. It is the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. We're looking at the portrayal of teenagers today, talking about the misconceptions surrounding young people. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Do you see teens making good choices? Michael Axelrod stays with us. He is a professor of psychology at the UW-Eau Claire. Let's go back to the phones now with Carly joining us from Appleton. Hi, Carly.
Hi. I just had a question and more so of an experience as well. When I was growing up and I was a teenager, my mom was also going through hormonal changes, menopause. So it kind of created a disaster in the house. We couldn't see eye to eye, and she wasn't able to relate to me, and I wasn't able to relate to her. And so it was really hard going through the changes, so I ended up reaching out to one of my aunts. But I was wondering how common that is, if teenagers are going through, especially hard for females, not having a female role model in the house, because you kind of become almost rebellious. towards everything that your mother wants.
Carly, thank you for sharing those thoughts. Michael, what about that?
Yeah, well, the first thing is that we have to be careful about assigning too much causality to hormones. What we know from research is that actually the activities that we do affect our mood way more than our hormones, particularly in the teen years. So that's the first thing that comes to mind in terms of what Carly said. The other is about role models. And there's a whole lot of research to suggest that role models are critical to adolescence. But role models don't have to necessarily be parents. They can be, in Carly's case, an aunt who's very supportive. Many teenagers find role models in school with teachers and coaches. They're role models in the community through organizations and volunteer opportunities and religious affiliations. So helping teenagers find role models is really important. And it's okay for teenagers to have more than one role model. So if a parent is feeling like, well, my teen seems to gravitate toward a particular coach for support and guidance, that's not all that bad.
Let's bring in Callie now from Rice Lake. Callie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind about this?
Hi, I am 22 years old, and I think you guys were discussing emerging adulthood as a phase. And when I was 18 years old, I didn't feel like I was prepared for college at all. I didn't feel like I had the social skills, but as I've been growing just through the last 4 years or so, that emerging adulthood period where I'm still learning, still developing cognitively, I believe it's true. I'm a lot more experienced than I was back then, and I think it's more of a myth that 18-year-olds are prepared as they're coming out of high school.
Kelly, thank you for those thoughts. And this emerging adulthood, do we know enough firm evidence how that brain is developing and how you're finding your sure footing?
Well, that's the developmental period. We're just really beginning to understand because we've now identified it as a developmental period. Previously, I think what we found was you either lumped a 20-year-old, for example, as an adolescent or as an adult. And I think that was very unfair to 20-year-olds and people that are just, again, trying to figure out what their life path is going to be, learning, those sorts of things. From a brain perspective, again, what we're finding is from the research that the brain continues to develop. And in that particular age, between about 18 and 25, it's actually the prefrontal cortex that's developing at a pretty rapid rate. And the prefrontal cortex is responsible for things like planning, organization, abstract thought, making connections between two unrelated ideas or seemingly unrelated ideas, those kinds of things. So what Callie described is not surprising to me.
We have only about a minute left with one more myth to debunk, but I really wanted to get to school violence on the rise. Can you talk about this particular myth and what you're getting at?
Yeah, so if we look at the long-term data on school violence, that would be serious crimes like school homicides and assaults, but even minor school crime like theft and those kinds of things. We've seen a decline since the 80s, which surprises a lot of people. I think, again, the media portrays schools as quite dangerous, but yet you're 175 times more likely to have a crime committed against you in your home than you are at school. But that's not to say that there aren't problems with violence in schools. The first half of 2018 is a good example where we saw a significant uptick in the number of school shootings.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
You're absolutely welcome. Thank you for having me, Kate.
Michael Axelrod is a professor of psychology and director of the Human Development Center at UW-Eau Claire. He also chairs the Institutional Review Board for the Protection of Human Subjects. He recently co-authored the book Great Myths of Adolescence, and he joined us from our studios in Eau Claire. A Across the country and in Wisconsin, there is a growing group of older parents. Their children are grown, but still can't care for themselves. They're part of the first wave of families to keep children with disabilities at home instead of institutionalizing them. Corrine Hess reports now many of these parents are struggling with how to guarantee their children are cared for when they're gone.
Once a month, about a dozen parents meet for coffee in a small room in the Milwaukee suburb of Wauwatosa. Before having an opportunity to mingle, they usually hear from a speaker. The topics range from financial literacy to housing. The group of otherwise strangers share a common bond. They have adult children with disabilities. They themselves are aging, and unlike the generations before them, they didn't institutionalize their children. They cared for them at home, and now they need help. Richard and Teresa Zimmerman have been regulars at the Coffee Connections program for a while. Both in their mid-60s, the couple is worried about their 34-year-old son, Neil. Neil has had cerebral palsy since he was an infant.
You hear about group homes. We don't think his situation would really apply to a group home because of the need that he has,
the level
of care. You would have to have three shifts of people eight hours a day in order to care for him.
Neil is wheelchair-bound. He can't go to the bathroom on his own, and he can't talk. His parents have not gone on vacation in 15 years. The Zimmermans have a 31-year-old daughter who is a teacher in Madison. They don't want her to have to worry about Neil when they are gone. That's one of the reasons they are starting to look at options for Neil.
It's a matter of trying to make sure that she's not going to be having to make the big decisions later. That's why we're looking into the future for us, you know, as far as what's going to happen.
A $25,000 grant from UnitedHealthcare has made the Coffee Connections program possible for the last year. It's run through Wauwatosa nonprofit Life Navigators. The monthly program gives parents raising adult children with disabilities a chance to come together and discuss common fears. Holly Davis with the Department of Aging for Milwaukee County says many caregivers never get a break. Being able to meet other people in the same situation can be one way to relieve stress.
There are a couple of different age groups of caregivers, right? So we have the sandwich generation where they're caregiving for an older parent and then a younger child with a disability. Mm-hmm. They're still of working age, and so it really taxes and stresses them that way. And then you have the other group of caregivers who are elderly and have these children, adult children, that are still dealing with their disability.
At a recent Coffee Connections meeting, the group heard from Lisa Voisin. Voisin is a regular attendee whose son Adam was diagnosed with cerebral palsy when he was 2 years old. Adam is now 26 and has been confined to a wheelchair his entire life. About 8 years ago, Lisa and her husband decided it was time for Adam to live independently. They bought a house large enough for Adam's wheelchair near their home in the Milwaukee suburb of Muskego. They also found roommates who have disabilities to live with Adam. He has been on his own for 3 years.
You know, your biggest fear as a parent is somebody going to take advantage of my son? Which has happened in small ways, but it's happened. And you have to accept that because you have to weigh it with the advantages of him being out on his own.
When Adam moved, Lisa planned to spend the first 2 weeks in the house. Adam asked her to leave after the first night, but she is called often. He or his roommates fall out of bed, or they have an accident and need help getting to the bathroom. Lisa and her husband are in their 40s, but they worry about what will happen when they are too old to care for Adam. Going to Coffee Connections, the couple is hoping to find answers. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.